life's gone down the drain. Your body's wrecked with pain. There's just one thing to blame. Dynamite in the brain.
You are listening to the Mononoke episode of Dynamite in the Brain anime podcast. I am Brian Smith, and as ever, no, as rarely, over there is my guest co-host, Niall Flanagan, because Anthony Askew is missing.
Hello!
We don't know what happened to him. He was swearing at his speakers or sound card on his computer earlier in the day, and since then he's gone silent.
This is the work of a yokai.
It must be, yes. And we are joined today by the host of the Anime Now podcast. It's Bradley Meek.
Hey!
Hello, Bradley. And Niall and Bradley, I'm going to have to rely on you to do a lot of the talking today because I have a terrible sore throat.
Uh-oh.
So if I go croaky or silent, that is why. And we are here today to talk about the 2007 anime Mononoke, directed by Kenji Nakamura. And is described by its Australian distributor, Siren Visual, thusly. In the Edo era of Japan, as cultural arts, modern science, and technology flourished, so too did the practice of mystical arts, as humanity faced the perils of the supernatural. In such an era, a mysterious medicine vendor confronts the humans and monsters with his scared sword for salvation. I think that's a typo there, Siren Visual.
You've also spelled
vendor wrong as well. After a year, the creators from Bakaneko came back once again with a flamboyant CG texture in a classic Japanese painting style to produce the new series, Mononoke, with the medicine vendor as the main character, as in their previous series, Bakaneko, which was the last story in the Ayakashi Samurai Horror Tales, I think the translation.
Yeah.
The full title was, which was now, a series the year before.
Was that... Oh, okay, that's odd, because I read somewhere that Ayakashi came out in 2006, so I thought it was, like, a short selected for
broadcast. It was 2006, so this was 2007, so year before was back in Echo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm still in 2001, mentally, for other reasons that will probably be clear later.
Yeah, it'll be clear next week. Yes. So it was a anthology show. There was three stories. The first two were direct adaptations of historical ghost stories, and then this last one in that series was Bakaneko, which introduced this character of the medicine vendor, the medicine seller, the medicine peddler, depending on which translation you're looking at. And that was an entirely brand new story, and they carried it on here. Of sorts, the character carries on. There's not really a through thread of a story.
And I think he's translated also as the humble medicine vendor. And whenever a character introduces themselves as humble, you know that they are anything but.
Just being modest. Howdy, Ghostbuster.
Have any of you seen that original Bakaneko story?
I have not.
No.
No, me neither.
I meant to get around to it, you know, because like I was kind of like, glad this now. I thought, I should probably get around to that to see like how it follows on. But at the time, thanks work.
Yeah, I originally saw this series fan subbed end of 2007 in like a rush to get through like the things which were supposed to be good of that year. Back when I felt that was something I had to do, and really enjoyed it, and then it. I think in the last couple of years, it got a US release from CineDigium, which was ridiculously cheap. I think like $16 or something crazy like that. And then late last year, it was put up on Crunchyroll. And if you're in the US, you can see it.
Okay.
Or if, like me, you can pretend that you're in the US and you can't be bothered putting your DVD in the DVD player, you can also watch it that way.
I forgot it got a release here. I was under the impression that it was one of those shows from the mid-2000s that could just never be licensed because it was just too out there.
Mm. Yeah, like I said, it had an Australian release earlier than that from Siren Visual. But yeah, I was surprised when it suddenly showed up from like this label who doesn't normally release anime. And I was like, and then it, and also it was dirt cheap.
What do they normally release?
They're one of these weird labels who've just got a whole lot of everything.
Destroying everything in the
Sounds
wall.
Sounds like somebody's laundering money to me.
Apparently they're a leading independent content distributor. Uh-huh. They probably just go to... They just pick up things which are available to license. And figure out how they... So, looking at their site, you've got Night of the Wild, which is some sort of... from the writer of The Hitcher. You've got a documentary about Slash.
From Guns N' Roses?
From Guns N' Roses. Slash, Raised on the Sunset Strip. What looks like a western called The Keeping Room. A film called Zombie Fight Club.
Great.
A Japanese live-action film called The World of Kanako. And Take Me to the River, which I'm guessing is either a documentary or a concert film, because it looks like it's got loads of band names and the picture's a record. Yeah, so all sorts of everything is what they do. They've also got their other anime thing. Well, I don't think it's anime, is it? Speed Racer, Race to the Future.
Is that which one was that?
How is that not... Oh.
Is that the US Speed Racer thing?
There was like the new Bridges of Speed Racer.
It's a CG thing, and it looks quite
hideous.
CG
one, yeah.
Directed by Robert H. Bob Fuentes III, apparently.
What a name.
Probably
a big
name. Jinx.
Yeah, so they're one of those sort of labels. The people who pick up things which are available.
If they're sitting there buying.
Yeah. And there's a fair few of those. I used to come across them when I worked at Videolog, and you go, wow, that's a really eclectic collection of stuff nobody's going to buy.
Just believe in it that much. This is going to be like the sleeper hit of the season. Just you wait, Brian.
But you also realise there's like loads of little shops all over the place which just want cheap DVDs, or wanted cheap DVDs, to just fill shelves to get. So like garages, and weirdly a post office once.
You know, that kind of company almost makes sense now in the age of streaming, when streaming companies want as many titles as possible, kind of like those old store shelves wanted as many titles as possible just to fill space.
Yeah, because obviously they must have picked up the digital rights as well, because they then sub-licensed it to Crunchyroll.
Yeah. It's what the kind of company who was putting like tapes of like Captain Harlock and Princess Knight at supermarket checkout when I was a kid that I took a chance to see then.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So we've got five stories here, all written by a variety of people. So the first one is by Ikuku Takahashi, who I know her from writing the film Ashura. The film about the cannibal child, which I'm pleased played at the cinema because no one's picked that up for home release.
I've seen her in Library of War as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I kind of liked. I remember liking it. Anyway.
Is that an anime movie?
No, it's a TV show.
TV show, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think they made a live-action version as well, haven't they?
They either did or are going to.
Yeah. Then you've got a couple, the second and fourth arc are written by Chiaki J. Kanaka of All Sorts of Things fame, but I've written down Serial Experiments Lane and Armitage III.
Big O.
But that's not really his thing. He does write on that, but those two are more his thing. But yes, Big O as well. Anything, and if you run across something which is heavily got Lovecraft references, good chance he wrote it. And the middle arc is by Manabu Ishikawa, who also wrote, I think, the next Kenji Nakamura series, Welcome to Arabu's Office. And he also wrote on another yokai-related show, Yozakura Quartet Hanano Uta.
Well, he was adapting a manga in that one.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, he's adapting a book in Welcome to Arabu's Office, but... And finally, showing up in the last arc, co-writing with Ikuku Takahashi, we get Michiko Yokote, who was the writer of the Bakeneko arc in the previous year. And she shows up to finish off the Bakeneko arc, which rounds off this series.
Now, are all these screenwriters kind of co-writing with Nakamura?
I don't know, but I would guess so.
Yeah.
I would guess so. Because it's definitely his character, because he's carried across the two things. And the character design is by Takashi Hashimoto, who also does the animation direction, and they'll also show up on Welcome to Arabu's Office, which we'll get to eventually later this year. Unless Anthony really didn't like this, in which case he'll put his foot down and say we know he won't.
He seemed to be in a big rush to finish it, so I think it had some effect on him.
Yeah. And so there's only really one main actor, and that is Takahiro Sakurai, who plays the medicine vendor, who is currently to be heard as the voice of Osomatsu and Mr. Osomatsu. And also other roles, Griffith in Berserk and Polar Bear in Polar Bear Cafe. What a range he's got. Though, he does sound a little Osomatsu-like in places in here, which I... He was more of a scoundrel than I remembered him being in places.
I thought he sounded kind of like Polar Bear at
times. Yeah, I was getting Polar Bear more, so now I'm hurt. I can never watch Polar Bear Cafe the same way ever again.
I'm pretty sure if we delved into Pixiv, we'd find some interesting crossover artwork. Because the medicine seller as a character, I think, did have a bit of a following in fan art circles.
This is kind of like, I guess Andy would say this if he were here, a very Vampire Hunter D type quality about him. He's just this pale, mysterious character wandering from place to place, killing monsters, solving mysteries.
Kind of. I think the big thing about D, though, is he has this backstory about being half human, half vampire, and he's very conflicted about what he does. Whereas the medicine seller, like, he has no backstory. He just exists. He is, so to speak.
Yeah. He's actually quite enthusiastic about what he does.
There's that, yeah. And he's quite sinister. It's almost like he kills Mononoke just for the sake of it, not to protect people.
Mm. He's a very, like, aloof character as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He gives very little away, and I like at times when people call him out on that. It's like, Mr. Medicine Center, what do you think this monster could be? Could it be like, the Umibozu? And he's like, ooh, maybe. They were kind of like, well, maybe you could like knock out the attitude and give me a straight answer, huh?
Yeah, he does not have good people skills, and I don't think he cares if he did.
No. He's got good dead people skills, though. So was this the first time you guys had seen it, or had you seen it before?
This is my first time watching it. I can remember, like, last year a lot of fervor about it. And I actually thought it was a more recent show, but just because it had been, I guess, put up on Crunchyroll for US people, so they were getting excited about seeing it. And I just wanted to see that I just meant to get around to. And I actually watched all of this in one night. I had to I was doing days, but I had to adjust for getting onto a night shift, so I basically had to stay up all night. So I blitzed through all of this like in one night. It did about like four and a bit hours. So I was like this, watching like two very long movies or one very very long movie. And it was actually quite good because, you know, it was up late at night. You know, I'm up by myself. It was very windy outside, and I'm watching these guys' spooky ghost stories. And principally, I had some very, very bizarre dreams as a result. I think it stands to its credit that for those 4 and something hours, I just watched it like end to end and was completely enthralled by it.
How are you, Bradley?
Yeah, this is a series I had always heard as an absolutely fantastic work of art that I needed to see. But I had kind of given up on seeing it because, again, I never thought that it would be licensed here in the U.S., and I'm too lazy to pirate anything anymore. So I'm so glad Crunchyroll picked it up. It is, you know, it's a series that keeps being mentioned largely because Kenji Nakamura is fairly prolific, and I love just about everything he does. And every time his name is mentioned, ANN will always mention, oh, he was also the director of Mononoke and Suritama and so on. So I was pretty excited when you offered me the chance to talk with y'all about this, because it was finally the reason I needed to go out and make myself watch the show.
And now you've done it. What did you think? Did you enjoy it?
I really liked it. You know, as hyped as it was, I wasn't quite sure what to expect. And it was very different from what I expected, even though I'm fairly familiar with Kenji Nakamura at this point. I think I've seen every series he's made since C, which was a really, like, flawed mixed bag that I loved largely because of its visual style. And here the visual style is closer to C than it is Gatchaman Crowds, I would say, or Suritama. Suritama feels almost like out of left field compared to everything else he's made. And that visual style, and especially its narrative style, which is very disjointed and non-linear, just contributes to this really spooky, scary, colorful show. It does really colorful horror, which, whereas other horror stories would go to just using a lot of black and a lot of darkness to be spooky, this just has lots and lots of color. And it creates this discordant effect watching it. And goodness, it is genuinely frightening and filled with dread at times. And I watched it largely in two sittings over two nights and really enjoyed it, even though a lot of these stories, I couldn't tell you a definitive linear answer of what actually happened. More like just how as it peeled through each layer of what you're seeing, it eventually comes to the core of the truth of what's actually happening. Like a chamber mystery, which is what Brian compared it to, where everybody is in the same room, but it's also a mystery about how much of what you're perceiving is actually true. And the whole thing's just really engrossing. So I really liked it.
Yeah, I as I mentioned, watched it in 2007. Really liked it then. It was on, I think, my 13th when we did our top 100 episode.
Mm.
And watching it again now, it flew by. I was surprised how, because as you say, it's most of the time it's a bunch of people in a single or maybe two locations talking to each other, and you think that would drag. But it's like, oh, blimey, it's to be continued already.
Yeah. It gets its hooks in, like, pretty early, like, you know, like, you know, people arrive to you and something strange is happening or it's about to happen, and, you know, one of you guys did it or is it or is related to it somehow, and then you're like, going, oh, who's it going to be then? But, watching it over again, is that same appeal there, or what are you waiting for then?
It's more sort of what clues are there in the way the story is being told that is sort of a precursor to the reveal that maybe you wouldn't pick up on the first time you watch.
Yeah. So it really holds up on a second viewing, I'm guessing, where you feel like it plays fair.
I think it does, but at the same time, as you mentioned, sometimes it's hard to figure out exactly what's happened. Borne out by comparing the synopsis on Wikipedia to your own viewing of it and to comments on Crunchyroll as to what people thought happened. Particularly the third arc seems to be the one where people...
Is that the one with the Chimera?
No, it's the one... It's the one with the... Man in the Fox mask.
Yes.
Where I think some people leap to a much darker conclusion than the thing seemed to suggest to me.
Well, can we get into that specifically? Tell me what you think happened. Because my perception of it was essentially that, spoiler alert, the woman who is also the Mononoke, apparently, had committed suicide, and this is the medicine seller basically kind of using therapy to move her to the next life.
See, that is the interpretation I saw other people making. That wasn't the interpretation I took. I took that the suicide itself is also metaphorical.
Yeah.
The suicide is that she chooses not to run away.
Oh, okay. Huh. Okay, so she chose not to run away, but did she actually murder those people?
No, no one was murdered.
Okay.
She was killing herself by not leaving that loveless marriage.
Okay, so, and then at the end of the show, she leaves. She realized that she needs to leave.
Yes, because the door's open and the medicine seller's there.
Yeah.
And so the other thing is, do you think the medicine seller was the man in the fox mask as well?
No, I didn't interpret that at all. So I thought that was her desires, more or less, that eventually manifested into
a... Now, there's a line where it says that the Mononoke is taking control of that man. That man is not the Mononoke. So, and he makes another line about... The medicine seller makes another line, I can't remember exactly what it was, which suggests that he was also taken with her, and then that's the clue that he's also the man in the fox mask.
Huh.
Okay.
Oh, gosh. But he's basically then in two places at once, right?
Yes. Which he can do.
Whew, I guess. By the way, for a story that I think you had a much better grasp of what happened than I do, I'm persuaded by your interpretation. I didn't get what was happening. I was still close to tears by the end of that story arc. Something about that moved me.
Yeah, see, I wish I could remember how I read it the first time I saw it. Unless I did write on it on my blog, so let me see if I actually put any comments about along that line. But I probably didn't. I probably just did a very perfunctory explanation of what I thought of it. Yeah. But yeah, no, this time round, I think possibly because I've seen Welcome to Arabu's Office, that the same guy wrote a bunch of episodes for and was the... head writer for, it feels a lot like that, of working somebody through their problems.
Okay. Right. With a similar theme of how you need to get out of this situation. It is within your power, at least.
Yes. Welcome to Arabu's Office is very specifically about mental health. Because the main character is a psychiatrist who has three different forms.
Okay.
And so each episode is sort of guiding somebody through whichever problem they've got. But often it's not like, it doesn't have quite a pat solution as this episode does of either passing away to the, going towards the light or just going towards the light. often it deals with mental health a bit more seriously and sort of says, yeah, you've got, a lot of it is just saying, you acknowledge that you've got a problem and this is how best to cope with that problem. Mononoke, let me look at that other one. Oh, I've got an Anthony clicking on me. It's not finding his audio devices. Oh, there you go. No Anthony for us. Did I say...
Ask him if he liked the show.
Okay, let's ask him.
I do want to hear that.
Not once for yes, twice for no.
Okay, let me type in. Bradley wants to know if you liked the show.
Conjuring the spirits from the great beyond.
Finally podcasting by Ouija board.
They said it couldn't be done.
He says he didn't see the ending.
Oh,
so he can't tell us.
Well,
that's not an answer.
He wants to look at it non-stop.
Well, that being said as well, you know, he might not have seen the last arc, shall we say, but, you know, out of the stories he has seen, did he enjoy it, you know? Because, you know, there's no true, like, ending to it. No, it's just the end of an arc, like, you know? So how many stories did he see?
The spirits are very indecisive.
He says, very much so, when I asked him, did you like what you saw? The main character is amazing.
Okay.
Huh. here we go.
Thank you, spirits.
You're welcome.
Okay. Apparently, I thought it was much more ambiguous when I first watched it.
Well, I can see how the way it goes. When at the end, when she like leaves the kitchen, goes outside, and the husband asks me, shouting, "Hey, oh Joe, what are you doing? Like, get back here! What are you doing?" Like, it could be kind of thinking, you know, is she leaving to? Like, no, just leaving, or is she leaving to, you know, like, go kill herself or hang herself in a tree? Because I get what I was going to do, or that's like, what kind of freedom Is she like taking here now freedom from life or just life of freedom, should I say?
I think she just wants to go outside, because we see that in the flashback to her as a child. It's like the part of her which she's putting on the mask for her mother,
yeah,
of being the girl who wants to be the bride of a samurai in the future. But then we see this part of her, which is presumably the part which turns into the Mononoke, wanting to leave to go outside and play with a ball.
Mm.
Okay, let's do this for all these arcs then. Let's rewind back to the first arc. Zashiki Warishi is the first arc, where we have a pregnant woman show up at a tavern in the rain, and there's also a medicine cellar there.
I like, by the way, the visual touch that shows that the rain is really cold, because mixed into the rain are snowflakes.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, it makes me like how it's rendered now, just like this, you know, it's just this like very, very like a style snowflake now, and it's just, it just looks enormous. It's just like just not just a kind of like floating down, like, no, as you would see it, like just, mm-hmm, kind of like swaying to and fro. It's just like, well, it's going straight down, even just kind of little trail line. You know, it's a very kind of like simple, like straight like line of color, but it fits in with the rest of the visuals now, which are like, you know, big kind of pastel color, like an old Japanese print.
This was the episode that was hardest for me to watch, just because it's a process to get used to how this series tells a story.
Yeah.
And it makes no apologies for it. There is no, you're not given any adjustment period. You just either go with it or you don't. And it took me a couple episodes. I think midway through the second episode is when I really started to feel like this was something I liked a lot. But it took some time to get used to.
Mm. Well, I think it helped, like, you know, when you got around to establishing like what the protocol is for finding out what the Mononoke is and how to exercise it, you know, because he needs to fulfill these three conditions, where he just needs to know like the the form of the Mononoke, the truth of it, and the reason for it. And no, mm-hmm, and he can't unsheathe his sword until he meets those three conditions. So he then like going through the whole thing where he knows what it is, why is it here, and what does it want? You know, and kind of interrogating the place and the people there to try and establish what those are.
Right, that's the mystery part of the mystery parlor of the show.
Mm.
So let me give a recap of what I thought happened, and y'all tell me if this reflects your understanding. Essentially, the inn... So the core of the horror of this is that the inn used to be a brothel, right?
Yeah.
At least several decades ago. And in the brothel, the women who were sex slaves, more or less, when they got pregnant, the owner of the brothel would force them to have an abortion.
Yep.
And the ghosts that are haunting the room where they had those abortions... are essentially the fetuses or the babies who wanted to be born. And that is the room that the guest ended up staying in. And because she's pregnant, the ghosts are attracted to her and want to use her as a vassal to be born.
Yep, yep. I think that's exactly what it is.
Okay. Now, the ending is where I'm confused. How was this resolved? Because
I believe she has a miscarriage.
How?
I think people have pointed out, and I didn't go back to rewatch this, is that the spirit of her baby got displaced when the ghosts were trying to. So they're trying to inhabit. So it's like the first one she sees is the one which cracks at the end. I think that's what happens. I didn't go back and double check.
Huh. No, that makes sense.
So, like, the first Dharma that she sees, because the babies are kind of represented by Dharmas and red wraps representing the umbilical cords.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first one she notices is the yellow one, which cracks at the end. And then after the credits, obviously, she she is no longer pregnant, though she still seems to think she is.
That ending was somehow a lot worse than I thought it was.
Yes.
Wow. Not as in bad quality. I don't know if I'm willing to say that, but oh, wow, that is bleak. That is really bleak.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, if you like this, watch her adaptation of Asherah, because you like bleakness and dead children.
Mm. Like a lot of these, he appeared at the medicine center, like he's not necessarily here to try and save these people. He's here to exercise the Mononoke and, make it stop what it's doing. And, I'll try and, get these people out of the situation if I can, but, if people are probably going to die.
Thinks that. I think he's entirely indifferent to human life and suffering.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so, because in the fourth arc, he makes the point that he was originally going to ignore some of the other characters there, but then he decided he would help them. Well, we'll get to that when we get to the fourth. I think he has, and obviously he seems to like cats. In the final arc, he seemed more concerned about the cat than the human involved. I think this may be, it may throw you in at the deep end. I wonder if you watched it in a different order, this would still seem the most daunting. Because I think this plays with its geography. I think they all play with their geography a fair amount, but this one plays with it a lot.
That's it. You get lost in, because it's the same room repeating, but it's a little different here and a little different there. And then it's got a whole different layout than in this room. So you're kind of thinking, is this in the past, in the present, the future? Where mm-hmm. are we?
Mm-hmm. But again, that contributes to the sense of unease throughout the series. You don't really know where you are, right? And you don't know where the characters are, so there's no way of knowing if they're safe.
There's loads of... I didn't notice whether this one's more than the others, but there's lots of shots of people where they're right to the side of the screen. And so the rest of the screen's filled up with the background.
Yeah. You're kind of just waiting for something to happen there.
Yeah.
And often nothing does.
No. It's just a sense of unease, as if, the location itself.
Yeah. It's often there to illustrate that, suddenly that this part of the room that, it was just, let's say, yellow a minute ago, and now it's all this, door frame is all that red, and it's it's been covered by the red wraps of the Zaziki or issues. It's like, oh, wait, that wasn't red before. What the fuck could that mean? Oh, it's a ghost.
And also some jagged edits, which aren't like jump scares, but they're just there to unnerve you. It's like... and the one effect they do a lot, and I don't think it works that well, is when it's sort of they'll sort of be a panning shot and it will ghost the image, so you'll get a after image of where the shot was before when something supernatural is happening. And I think that's the one thing which I don't think works that well. Maybe it's just a digital effect they were taken with.
Yeah, but I thought it was just a bad version of it. It's just this is artifacting all over the place.
But we should mention the other digital effect they do all the way through is the entire thing's got this paper-like texture. Did that work for you guys?
Yeah, this is a good application of using, making CG kind of work for you, and making it fit in, and it meshes very well, everything else, and doesn't seem out of place. Because we think of CG anime, you're thinking, okay, everybody would be the characters would look okay, the backgrounds would be probably look alright, and then they'll get a taxi, and then this boxy, low frame rate CGI car will come into the thing, and they get in the taxi, and whatever, and that takes me right out of it altogether. But here, it's just, from the off, it's enmeshed into the fabric of the thing, so mm-hmm. to speak.
It's very consistent, and it really works for me.
And as a thing, there was an effective thing there, and if it's similar as well, like, you know, because that papery quality, when it's like doing, like, we'll say, like, a sequence of shots just kind of slightly altering the thing, the card will, like, the screen will, like, you know, have, like, pages turning, so it'll turn over the page, a little different again, a little different again, and that, again, that ties into the, again, the fabric of the show, you know, and they know what they're doing, you know, like, how to play around with it, which is good.
Okay. Anything else on that arc before we move on to the next one?
I'm good.
The only other thing I noticed is the character designs of the inn staff and the pregnant woman seem a little anachronistic. In that you've got a black guy as the manager of the inn, and the woman is like overly drawn. The pregnant woman is overly drawn as Caucasian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering what's happening with that.
Yeah, that was probably my least favorite element of the show. What was going on with that? Comedy black guy and innocent naif white girl. It's weird.
Yeah, I don't know. Don't know what they were going for there. Unless it was just to add to the sense of unrealness, maybe, of the era.
This could happen anywhere at all.
Because it would actually make sense if the next one. So the next arc is Umi Bozo, or Sea Bishop, where we're on a boat. They're sailing back to Edo, aren't they? Because the owner of the boat's got a load of goldfish he's brought from foreign lands to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got on the boat, we've got Kayo, who is a maid from the Ayakashi Bakaneko story. She's a recurring character, who sort of recurs again later on.
Yeah.
She's played by the actress Yukana. And I noted she voices Shirahoshi in One Piece. And that's the giant mermaid princess who first appears in a One Piece arc that features an Umi Bozo of sorts, or a character who gets nicknamed an Umi Bozo. You've got the trader, we've got a guy called Genyusei, who is this mystic travelling minstrel type guy played by Tomokazu Seki. And I recognised the voice, and I looked him up, and I was like, I know him anyway, but is it the same voice he uses for Wiz in Yo-Kai Watch?
It was very similar.
Yes, I don't know if it was the same voice or just the fact that he's always going on about how much he knows about Yo-Kai.
It's the kind of haughty quality, think of it as.
You've got this samurai with a scarred face who's sort of very creepy. And then there's a monk and his bishop. Is there anybody else on board?
There's the sea captain. There's like his first mate.
I'm trying to remember who has to tell the truth to the ghost fish in the second episode.
I think that's all of them.
But what happens is they're on this ship and someone has fiddled with the compass. They put a magnet next to it, causing them to go into this triangle filled with ghosts, specifically Ayakashi, because this is the first arc where we get the peddler telling us that Mononoke are Ayakashi, who've been formed into Mononoke by human emotions and needs and guilts and things. So he's got no chance of killing all the Ayakashi in the world because there's so many, but Mononoke, on the other hand, he's happy to take care of. And they run into this ghost ship, which comes out the sky. And then later on, a ghost biwa player, who is this fish with one human leg. And he's voiced by Norio Wakamoto. And he comes on board and asks them all to tell their truths. And otherwise he'll do something nasty to them, which apparently he will do to them anyway, even if they do tell the truth.
Yeah, it's one of those guys that, like, you know, I'm to look him up now. Okay, is like the Get News Diet says, no, just say this and he'll leave you alone. And there's a lot of those kind of like yokais and things in Japanese folklore, like, you know, they'll ask him a question or tell you to do something, and it's like, no, you can't say like yes or no. You gotta sort of like be in the middle.
Yes.
There's that one, like the snake, the slit face woman, you know, like, you know, she has her like her mouth cut like ear to ear, so she's kind of hanging out, and she'll appear to you and like she'll ask you, do I look beautiful to you? And if you say yes or no, she'll eventually kill you. West kind of say to her, it's like, yeah, you're kind of all right, you're okay. And that confuses her, and then you can get away from her. So this is like a similar thing going on here with the fishman.
Now, can you lie to the fishman? Because I think one of the characters successfully lies to him, but he still vomits on the other side of the boat.
Yeah, I don't know whether I just like the idea that he is actually afraid of steamed buns. But that is actually true. Yeah, so that is my favourite. This one, I think this has the most jokes in it.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the lightest of the stories, certainly.
It's a good palate cleanser after the first arc.
Yeah, because they go through all these graphic appearances of the hallucinations everyone's having as they get attacked by this fish. And then the last guy, Genyusai, after he said, oh, my biggest fear is steamed buns. And then we don't see what he's seeing. We just see him mime it out.
They're wondering what's going on. He's like, oh, a nice steamed bun. Oh my God. Blur. And I don't want to know why he was eating there. I don't want to see that. And also, like, you know, like, what we're saying is, let us know. Two in a row, potent bird trauma imagery going on here as well.
Yes. Yeah, because KO says, oh, my biggest fear is that I won't get married and won't have children. It turns out her biggest fear is actually having children.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Super gross.
Speaking of KO, I don't know if y'all noticed this, and I don't know if this was intentional, but sometimes her eyes, which are drawn fairly cute, so large, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes they would look too large. So not only does she look out of place compared to all the other characters in her natural design, but sometimes it was like when teenagers try to draw anime style for the first time and they make the
Dragon
eyes
Ball
too
Super.
Big. Yes. It's got that effect going for it. And I don't know if that was intentional, but it was kind of queasy to look at times.
I think she's definitely more traditionally designed than the others. She's kind of presented as the innocent in this story. Because even she thinks that the medicine seller is an innocent as well. But then after she said that, he deliberately says something to make himself seem guilty. And then we finally get the resolution. I think this one's fairly self-explanatory. So the bishop had dragged them into the triangle because the triangle's been caused, he thinks, by his sister who was sent off as a human sacrifice 50 years ago. And he also thinks that he was in love. It turns out the Mononoke is sort of all his suppressed feelings about his sister, and he's sort of taken on her feelings as if they were his.
It's also just suppressed feelings from being a monk from a very young age. He's also very greedy, that's revealed. He wants to be rich. He highly values material goods, so to speak.
Yes.
Which you're not supposed to do as a monk. No. So.
Yeah. I think it also as well, his sister was sent off to be a sacrifice to appease Daikashi. It was supposed to be him, but she went off in his place, and rather than, like, you know, feeling, you know, like, remorseful or regretful about this, yet she felt, like, relieved that it wasn't him, and that's tying into all of that as well.
Yeah, those feelings had become the Mononoke, and he'd forgotten those, because she was willing to go because she was in love with him, and as brother and sister, they could never get married. But in doing that, and him suppressing it all, it'd become, in his mind, that he was the one who was in love with her. And then weirdly, at the end, after this is all resolved, he becomes
an handsome prince.
Yes, incredibly beautiful man.
So I interpreted that as he's been purified now and
yes.
dead, but also purified. So yeah. I think it's a visual reference to a particular kind of Buddhist god, a Bodhista, I believe, is what he looked like. But I'm not entirely sure about that.
What I like about this one, this kind of happens earlier on where it kind of, it's, the clues are in there to, like, from the off as to what their alchemist will be. Because, I think it's even it's in the form prologue, the pre-credits bit to the first episode of this story, where they're all on a boat and it's like, oh, who are these people on the boat? Everybody introduce yourselves. And then they get around to, like, the monk and the bishop and it's like, oh, got a bishop on a boat at sea. So you got like a new Umi Bozu here. And wouldn't you know it, that's what happens.
Yeah, I don't think it's subtle about who the person is that's causing it, causing all the craziness. But how it happens, yes. I think, is an interesting resolution.
Because the other thing, which it is subtle about, is what's going on with the samurai. Because there's something else going on there, which he will refuse to give you any explanation for. And the medicine seller is not interested in that at all.
No. Did he even like give him like a post ending little bit in the last episode of it?
Yeah,
and it's like, what's this guy's story?
Yeah, you just see the medicine seller approaching in the background as his eye, as the short last bit of his sword shatters into his eye. Because he mentions something when he sees all the ghosts of the people he's killed, that it was the sword doing it, not him.
So, would it be some kind of cursed sword? We don't know.
We don't know.
Which is crazy, probably.
Yes.
He seems pretty bloodthirsty because he wants to like see the medicine center unsheath his famous sword. He wants to see it happen.
Yeah. Which I don't think you get to see, do you? As a human being. I think only people on the other side get to see the sword.
Hmm.
Anything else to mention on this? I thought the shots of the boat at the sea kind of felt like a Terry Gilliam animation, very flat. Mm. And
I think when the ghost ship came down out of the clouds, very much so.
Oh yeah, that particularly, yeah.
And it's shooting out those fishbone chains to ensnare everything.
Yeah,
they're pretty good as well.
Yeah, I think I enjoyed this on a second viewing more than I did the first time around.
Were you more like... Did you feel like, you know, it wasn't in keeping with what established in the first story?
I'm not sure. But I'm now looking at what the Brian of 2007 said, and he was much more clued in than the Brian of 2016. So, the name of the boat is the Solaris Maru, which is a reference to Stanislaw Lem's science fiction novel about characters confronting their repressed memories and thoughts. Which is exactly what happens here.
Huh.
That does seem very Kanaka thing to do.
Yeah.
Make a reference to
Solaris.
Yeah. No, I think I probably did like it as much then. But in the meantime, it was probably not stuck in my mind quite so much. Anything else you want to add to the third arc that we've mentioned already? I think we've probably covered everything.
No, I think we've got all right. We're still onto the fourth one.
Okay, the fourth one, was it called Chimera of Japan? Japanese Chimera?
Mm-hmm.
Nue.
New.
Where we meet three, what would you call them?
Scent
experts, aromatherapists,
incense aficionados,
incense fanatics, yeah. Incense otaku.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, you see, I think they were guys who wanted to make a lot of money because there's a lot of money to be made in scent.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, there was the one guy who was just completely out of his depth.
Yes.
Compared to the other two.
So they've come to vie for the hand in marriage of, what's it, Lady Ruri, was it?
Yes.
I think that was the name. And to do this, they've got to take part in a contest to identify a set of scents and then relate them to chapters of the Tale of Genji. And then create with wooden blocks the reference to that chapter. Is this going in your gaming panel?
I'm considering it now, because it was like this four dudes gathered around a table, you know, trying to outwit each other and and kind of like using their skills to. Using the skills rather than any kind of force weapon today. It did remind me, like, you know, it's like some kind of spooky aromatherapy version of Akagi going on here.
Apparently the Brian of 2007 says that he knows it's a real game but can't find a decent English language description of it.
It's a that little
such
like
an obtuse game.
It's a little like smell that tune.
Yes.
I suppose.
But yeah, I have to say, as a fan of playing games, I did get just the thrill of the sound effects of them with the wooden blocks under the table.
Yeah.
In a hurry to try and create the correct answer.
You know what the game kind of reminded me of was Hanafuda, which is dependent on knowledge of a set of poems to be able to play it correctly. And how many Japanese games like depend on knowing a lot about classical Japanese culture to be able to even begin to play it? It's just, it seems crazy obtuse to me.
Thankfully, Loveland doesn't have that problem.
Yeah. it's like, you know, saying if you want to play Connect 4, you got to know, like, Dostoevsky back to front.
Exactly, yeah.
I think it's to show that you were an educated man in that era. Hey, we haven't got to my game for this episode yet. You might be recreate Yokai Watch episodes using these wooden blocks.
Oh dear, I'm going to reveal how uneducated I am.
Talk, 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 there we go.
The country bumpkin of the bunch.
This one is less colourful. It kind of uses spot colours.
Yeah.
Quite often.
Like when they're inhaling the scent, they briefly like bloom into color,
yeah,
and then it goes back out again. That was really, really effective, I think.
But it turns out in this episode that the Mononoke is the Mononoke of a piece of wood. It's being created by the spirits of objects.
So the object bore a grudge that it wasn't appreciated enough? Is that what they said?
Yeah, it wants to be smelled.
Yes.
It smelled so much. Come over here and smell me. Or I'll kill you. Well, I'll kill you anyway. Just smell me.
I think it's I think it's more ambition than grudge. It wants people to think that it's this powerful object and to attract all these people to come here.
So what was the story arc of what actually happened? Because it's clear that everyone was murdered.
Yes.
By the time the medicine seller shows up. So the story that plays out for the past episode and a half before that reveal.
Yeah.
What's going on with that? Is he just talking to dead spirits?
He's talking to dead spirits. Because he said, is where he says, I was only here to deal with you, the Todaiji. But he felt sorry for these last four people who were there. And so I had to send them on their way as well. And then, of course, then we get the reveal of what state the building's actually in. The garden is just covered with graves.
Yeah.
But I do like that the dog, which we keep on seeing throughout these two episodes, is not part of this. It's just a dog who's wandering through the grounds.
Yes. That's a cute dog, too. I liked that dog.
Yeah. Actually, again, the medicine seller, he gets it in one. That's what's really going on, because his answer in the game is illusion.
Yes.
You know what's happening. He's just playing along.
I enjoy this one a fair bit. This was one which definitely stuck in my mind, and particularly the bit in the towards the end when they've realised when she tries to scare him off. The piece of wood tries to scare him off, rather, with bringing back the other guys as forms, and the guy who's got the who keeps his nose primed by covering it with a cone of paper, which makes him look like a mouse. Enters with dog bodies. I thought the three characters were fairly humorous as well. The three would-be scent moguls. What about you guys? Did you enjoy this one?
Oh, yeah. Just that game aspect is... like, it appeals to me immediately. And when he's playing at the second game, and it's like, okay, we'll go play the game. You gotta like smell the things and find out. We're gonna play it at the Princess Kaguya game. You know, we gotta have, like, you know, give me five smells, and one of these is gonna be Kaguya. So you just gotta guess which one it is. By the way, my mistake. I might have actually put a poison smell in there. So be careful around there.
I did like how that was after the two clever ways of getting rid of the other two guys. It's just like, well, let's just convince him that I've poisoned him. And that will send him to the other side. Yeah, a lot of good fun. Let's wrap things up with the final arc. Another three-parter called Bakke Deko, where apparently they've jumped to the 1920s. And the medicine seller hasn't aged a bit. Though, as he explains, he's only going to be able to sell medicine if he's dressed like this. It's part of the advertising. And we get shop dummies for any of the non-featured characters. The visual feature. We kind of had something similar in the very first arc where... sort of people's faces were like rotating flowers, were they?
Silhouettes, with claws and dab, and then the flowers spitting around them. Was that within any other arc? No, it wasn't. I suppose it weren't any other people. Maybe in the
faceless,
the third part one, yeah.
Because they've also got masks in that.
All the masks, and then like the family who were murdered. Now you want to see them as a print on a screen, and then it costs you to like these like still images, you know, as they're speaking. So that's kind of one where you kind of see them. Then
there's a similar effect that's used in a show called Manami K that was out at around the same time. But Manami K is supposed to be a soothing comedy about a surrogate family. And having all the non-main characters be basically black silhouette dummies was kind of unnerving, unintentionally so, I think. But probably a good cost-effective way to not draw a lot of things. So good on them for that.
It's pretty creepy when you see a bunch of them like gathering on a stairway and they're all just laughing. That's going, let me out of here.
We've got Yukata back playing another character, but this who looks pretty much exactly like K.O. if it was the 1920s. Who medicine seller seems to recognise, sort of gives her a knowing look early on. And then it brings back some of the actors from Ayakashi's Bakke Neko arc. Seiji Sasaki, who's playing the train driver in this. Yoko Sume, who's playing the housewife character. And Eiji Takemoto, who plays the editor. In fact, I should mention, Eiji Takemoto has a character in every single of these arcs. And I think he's also the voice of the sword when it talks. He's a guy who I'm guessing from his... Anime News Network entry is a guy at Toei who they get to do fill-in utility voices because he has a ridiculously long list of characters that he's played in One Piece and various other things.
He's the James Cromwell of anime.
Could well be. I can see James Cromwell playing this editor character in this story. And yeah, so there is a journalist who has apparently committed suicide, but is it suicide?
Was she pushed?
Was she pushed? We shall find out in these three episodes. Also, she has combined with a cat to form a back-end echo and is determined to take revenge on those responsible for her death. And so a collection of apparently unconnected people find themselves trapped on a train carriage, and it's up to the medicine seller to figure out what has caused this back-end echo to bring these specific people here. And this is kind of the one which works most like a actual murder mystery. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, because we're trying to solve an actual murder.
Yeah.
In a more traditional sense. Not some kind of figurative murder or spiritual murder. No, there's an actual, like, an old murder like that happened. And these people are lying to you, and they're trying to cover it up. Goes all the way to the tap, all the way to City Hall.
It does. My favourite touch, I think, of this is in episode 2, where all the suspects, as they disappear one by one, start scratching the various parts of their bodies that they didn't use to either prevent the murder or help the investigation of the murder.
Yeah, there's great sound engineering there, because it's like the sound that's scratching is just so discordant. It was like raising the hairs on the back of my neck whenever I was hearing it. It was making me feel really, really uncomfortable, which I guess it's supposed to be kind of fitting, but you know, just that sound is really grating on me. It looked very uncomfortable.
Bradley, what do you think of this one? Bradley, yeah.
I'm here. Yeah, I liked it. I liked it well enough.
I was appreciative of Crunchyroll comments pointing out the corpse at 11:50 in episode 10. It is very much blink and you'll miss it. The later one, they reuse repeatedly in the next episode, so...
Yeah.
But...
My favorite kind of little touch is that in the train tunnel, the lights on the ceiling are this cat's eyes just like watching over and over and over again. Or they appear to be shaped that way anyway. So as the train's speeding by, there's this pair of cat eyes now just constantly watching you.
I think the story all hangs together quite well of how all these people are tied to the murder.
Now the kids, a lot of the we'll say the adults here are like directly involved, or just for you know they were indifferent to this thing going on. They could have stopped it, but you just get a nice bite that day, and you saw a guy at a bridge, just leaning over it. Think, oh sure, there's a guy at a bridge, isn't it? And I felt like one, you're getting a bit of a raw deal, getting wrapped up in this. On this mess as well, isn't he?
He could have said something. Did the detective speak to him before? No, I don't think he did. I think he said he saw it in the newspaper. Once he saw it was a suicide, he didn't say anything. He thought that was it dealt with. Nothing else needed to happen.
Only 10, for God's sake.
But he could have connected the fact that he could have said, oh, I saw a man there at the same time. No excuse. Get his eyes scratched out. He did get to see the train, though, being pulled to the front carriage. He was happy about that, wasn't he?
Well, he died a happy boy.
They were all alive at the end.
I know.
So do you think the... Yeah, because it was kind of ambiguous as to whether anyone got their just desserts. Maybe he got eaten. Do you think he got eaten at the end? When the time
editor?
Wound back.
The editor guy, yeah? But he was the guy I was responsible for now, and it does seem to go, I've gotten away with this, but then things revert back to being weird again, and it would seem to suggest that, yeah, he, of all these guys, he's the one who's going to get what's coming to him. But I guess everybody else has gone through it, you know. I presume they all remember it as well, you know, the same way. But then so they just have to have these awful memories of being trapped in a train and being haunted by this ghost cat Maybe that'll set them straight for the remainder of their lives. But who's to say?
Because the biggest mystery is who put a little jacket on a kitten and then let it wander around town.
and of course, somebody must like own this cat because you know this they brought it to a vet. You know, it has a cone around its neck and everything.
Yeah, it is a pretty adorable creature from beyond.
Yeah, having not seen like the Ayakashi Bakaneko thing, it just does seem like and having a reference as well in the Yumi Bozu story, it's like the medicine center is coming. I know, like, you know, even now in the year 1920, I face my old arch nemesis, the Bakaneko.
Well, I think in that one, it's kind of similar to this one, where it's like, well, this is my job, getting rid of Mononoke, but I really don't like these people who caused this Mononoke to appear in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, it brought back, like, the Kaio-esque character as well. It's kind of a similar thing to Yumi Bozu, where we've got these people, like, trapped on a mode of transport together and trying to solve a mystery.
Yeah, I'm really additionally interested to see if there's visual references in this to the previous Bakaneko arc that we're missing, because I don't know what the Bakaneko looked like in that one. Whether it's the same kitten. Because when we last see that kitten, he's got like a high... It's not like the cone, he's got like some sort of high collar, like he's some sort of wizard of cats. Going on.
Cat wizard. Well, I probably believe that. I think this deserves kudos for having something like, you know, as you know, from the outside looking in, like something like a ghost cat making something as like innocuous as that seem actually quite terrifying in the execution in these three episodes.
Then would you like to go out being smothered to death by a pile of kittens?
With some people I know, that'd probably be the preferred way to die.
Because that is a weird visual. It keeps on cutting, and sometimes the editor's sitting on the seat of the train, and then sometimes he's covered in a pile of cats.
is he enjoying this? Or he's probably saying, oh no, I'm covered in a pile of kittens. Oh, help me.
I don't think even people who like kittens would like that, because of the way cats will sit on you, it's always butt first. So all you're going to see are kittens' butts,
the best
kitten buttholes around.
It's their best feature. That's why they're showing it to you.
That's the best part, you know. It's where all the vitamins are. Mm.
Yeah, so anything else to say about this? Shall we wrap things up? Anything else to mention about the show in general? One thing I want to say is the quality of the subtitles on the Crunchyroll and the DVD release take a real nosedive on the last arc.
They weren't that good to begin with.
But
there were pieces of dialogue that are just not translated because they can't have, what, two lines of dialogue on the screen at the same time?
I think that's
time.
It,
what
yeah.
The heck?
There's some timing problems, and then I think in episode 10 or 11 there's a bit where someone's obviously done a find and replace and accidentally put it in capital letters, so all of a sudden the character goes, VENDOR! In full caps. Yeah. So, it's cheap, but you're getting what you pay for.
It's a good show. I'm glad I got around to it. I feel like I would have anyway, but I think the way I experienced it this way, pretty much all in one go on a very spooky, windy night, really contributed to the atmosphere as well. And that's like that the opening theme gets into your head. I've had it in my head now for the last 2 days.
Yeah, same.
Well, I had it in my head, but then I listened to the Gegege no Kitaro song, and now that's replaced it in my head.
It just really gets in there, and it's like it's at the same time fairly jaunty and upbeat, but it has this like undercurrent of sinisterness to it as well. I don't know what it is.
It's just atonal enough to be creepy, but yeah. It has melody to carry the whole thing. So,
yeah. What is it? Is that like what is that like an accordion? Is that the main instrument, or a melodeon is the main thing?
I thought this sounded more like traditional Japanese instruments. What's the instrument that's kind of like a sitar, is native to Japan, possibly.
Shamisen, the Biwa, the...
Oh, I think it's the Biwa.
They got a few of them. Yeah. Fishman was playing one earlier on.
Yeah.
You know, I had a very like kind of like flamenco quick party tour. Like, no, it fits that the guy show up before. Hello, I am the medicine vendor. I am here to exercise the Mononoke.
I think they were getting accents this podcast.
Muchas gracias. Mononoke.
Anthony says he wants to cosplay as the medicine vendor.
I imagine he's probably a very popular cosplay character. Presuming there's people know about the show at all.
That's true. That is true.
So is a lot of the fan art of this guy porn? Is that
let's find out. Let me get a fan base. We can find out. I've got a login, so I can hit the R18 button and find out for you.
Because he is pretty and aloof, and that is a pretty alluring combination for Fujoshi.
On the cosplay front, yeah, lots of us, and everybody here has gone the whole hog. They, a lot of them as well, if they've like put on a lot of like pale makeup on top, as well as the other fish makeup to really sell the appearance on the hands too. So
there was only 3 pages of R18 Mononoke art on Pixiv, and many, many pages of fan art in general. So people are mainly interested in drawing his costume rather than him drawing him with his costume off.
Also, she cosplays here of his alternate form when he unsheathes the sword, which is also very elaborate.
Yeah, I think that would be part of the appeal for your hardcore cosplayers, is it's a rare anime costume which is as detailed as a computer RPG costume. So if you wanted to go overboard, there's plenty of opportunities. And he's got that medallion as well, and the sword you could make too. Could really, mm-hmm. And if you really want to go overboard, you could bring his backpack as well.
Box, yeah. Keep your lunchbox.
So I'm going to guess Anthony isn't going to cosplay.
Put on the list of, I'll do it if someone else makes it for me.
That is true. But yeah, he would be the choice, I think, of most people. But I think most characters in there, though, have got a good costume on.
They're all like pretty busy designs.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be a bad one in there.
Oh, and of course, these are rare anime characters who've got lips and make different shapes with their mouths when they're talking.
And individual teeth.
Yes.
Which I thought would be creepier, but actually I find quite appealing on most characters.
Of course, there's no Sumatsu crossover one. Of course there would be, and the sword is a Yami. Yeah, so it looks like still popular even today as a source of fan art. Either that or there's a few maniacs who just draw the character constantly. You can never quite be sure.
Just one guy to this day. For the last 8 years.
Righty ho. If that's everything, let's play a game of Earlier, Later, or Spot On, the Yokai Edition.
Woo.
Except it won't be Earlier, Later. It will just be... you'll see, anyway. You shall see. These are slightly different questions because I'd written them expecting there to be 3 people here. Anthony, you've let me down. I can't test out my different format. But it will work as this as well.
You get him down to type in his answers. Spirits.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question, Niall, and then Bradley will say whether the answer you've given is correct or the actual answer is higher or lower.
And if he's right, you can unsheathe his sword and destroy me.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So even if you're correct and he says you're correct, you don't get a point, he gets the point.
Okay, so I'm going to win this, or else I'm going to be sent to another dimension.
And then once you've done that, we'll switch over, and then Bradley will go. And we'll go. There's 10 of these questions. So we'll go back and forth until we have a winner. Okay, so, Niall. As of the 31st of January 2016, how many TV episodes of Yo-Kai Watch have there been? These are all Yo-Kai themed.
Okay.
Or ghost themed or supernatural themed.
72.
Bradley. Higher, lower, or spot on?
Okay, so the show has been airing for about, what, 2 years now?
Well.
I'm going to say higher.
You are correct. It's 105 episodes.
Done.
Okay, Bradley. How many manga volumes did Ushio and Toro run?
I'm going to say lucky number 13.
Niall.
Higher than that.
You are correct. 33.
Woo!
Shonen manga, man.
Niall. How many episodes did the original run of Inuyasha run for?
Original run is up to what point?
To the point the series stopped.
Okay.
Are you including the final act in that or not?
No.
Okay.
The original run, not that.
And was like how many episodes was it?
Yeah, how many episodes?
Ooh, let's say 172.
Bradley.
Lower than that.
You are correct. Lower by 5.
Oh!
167.
Yeah. I was obsessed with that series before. I remembered it was 160-something. So. And I've seen all of them, so...
Oh.
Yeah. Woo.
Life well spent.
Bradley.
Yeah.
What year did the first episode of Gay 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 No Kitaro air?
Of the very first.
The very anime, first, I'm yes.
I'm going to say 1977.
Niall.
Earlier.
That is correct, 1968.
Woo!
Right. Back to you, Niall. How many manga volumes did Nura, Rise of the Yokai Clan run?
Let me think. Lucky 21.
Bradley.
That's a persuasive number. I'm going to say lower.
Niall, you got a point. It's 25.
Ooh.
Okay. Bradley, how many brothers are there in the Shimogamo family from Eccentric Family?
Oh. I'm going to say 4.
Niall.
There's a show about family, and it's a big family, I understand, so I'm going to say higher than that?
No, Bradley was spot on, it was 4.
Shit!
Okay, Niall. Across all of its series, how many episodes has Natsumi's Book of Friends had?
How many... I mean, what now? Sorry, dude.
Across all its series, how many episodes?
Episodes.
TV episodes has Natsumi's Book of Friends had?
50.
Bradley.
Slightly higher, I believe.
You are correct, 52.
Duh!
Consistent
13
episodes each season.
13 episodes each. Yeah, the jinx.
Okay, Bradley, what year did the original Dororon Enmakun anime begin?
Ooh, 1968.
Niall.
Later.
That is correct, 1973. Final question for you, Niall. As of Generation 6, how many Pokemon are ghost types?
Holy shit. It's just the most recent iteration of it, yeah?
I think so, yes.
Okay, so that would mean there's about 900 of them. So, how many would be ghosts? Maybe there's enough for 150.
Bradley.
Lower.
That's correct, 35.
That all.
I think they keep Ghost as a fairly rare type in Pokemon.
I know. I've lost a whole run of like how many there are. For I'm pretty sure there could be like 10,000 Pokemon types out there, and I'd probably believe you.
Yeah.
And final question for Bradley. You're currently in the lead.
Oh boy.
How many episodes were there of the Holic live action TV drama?
Oh wow. I'm gonna say 13.
Niall.
A little more?
No, a little less. 8. Bradley, you're the winner. 6 points to 4.
No, my soul is gone.
Bradley, anything you want to plug?
No, even the podcast is dead at this point. So I will release my last episode whenever I get around to it. I just haven't been in the mood to watch anime recently. And by recently, I mean in about the last 4 or 5 months. So... the podcast is dead for now. I'll probably resurrect it when I feel like watching anime again, but who knows when that will be.
Okay, Niall. Anything happy to report on your end?
Well, I can report on my own podcast. You can just say that Madness is still running strong. I mean, about to run into our fourth year now of it, so all right. And that's talking about cartoons and other things, some anime involved in there. And that can be found at secretsofmadness.blogspot.com. In the meantime, you can find me occasionally on Twitter at Nicholas Cage. That's N-I-A-L-L. Say what AS underscore Cage. As of course, allowing for the fact that people will still be on that if this Twitter apocalypse comes true, which they're like ranting and raving about.
People will still be on it. And of course, you can find me and Niall on the other podcast on this feed that you're listening to this on. Let's Go, the weekly anime podcast about weekly anime. If you want to know why Bradley doesn't watch anime anymore, we've drained his anime watching powers. And we're powering out other podcasts with it. We are anime vampires.
And of course, okay. You can have my powers. I grant them to you. You are worthy successors.
Evil.
And you can find this podcast on dynamiteinthebrain.com, iTunes, Stitcher, Player.fm, and many other aggregation sites. And if you have not already, please subscribe and write a review on one of those things so that more people can find out about the future ghosts that are Dynamite in the Brain. Goodbye.
Oh, that's grim. Goodbye.
Sayonara.
Your life's gone down the drain. Your body's wrecked with pain. There's just one thing to blame. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain.